I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we talk about evolution and the faith, evolution of faith and religion. For many people, their relationship with religion, faith, and participation in church is very different than it was several decades ago. Although some faiths and faithful have maintained tradition, overall, the religious landscape has changed dramatically. Joining us to talk about some of those changes and the role of faith, spirituality, and church or synagogue in our lives is Ann Fox, who's a minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
Bruce Epperle is a pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville. Good morning.
It's a pleasure.
Elias Lieberman, rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Deborah Warner, rector at the Church of Messiah here in Woods Hole.
Good morning.
All right. Rabbi Lieberman, let's start with you. How has the religious landscape changed over the past few decades? And what do you think people are looking for from their church or synagogue?
Mindy, I think that it's changed in certain kinds of ways. I think that what I see is that we're seeing the results of a consumer society. People are looking for things that they can obtain and use and perhaps then set aside. And I think that that holds true of the religious marketplace as well. It has become a marketplace. In my own experience in the synagogue world, people will sometimes join a synagogue in order to educate their children. Once they feel that's been accomplished, they leave the congregation. Mm. This is something that's been happening over a number of decades.
Yeah. Anybody else want to share
another? I would say that pluralism is really part of our world. And it's not just the pluralism of a variety of churches, but it's what some people have called digital pluralism. That if you go online, you can find 500 different types of religious experience in a matter of minutes. And of course, at least in my congregation and others around, there are folks who have come from a variety of denominations where there used to be a brand loyalty to a particular one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody else want to chime in on that? Mm-hmm.
I think for the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church, with regards to our liturgical styles, that's changed a lot. We're certainly much more eclectic in terms of the drawing in the different traditions within the Anglican Communion. So our hymnal, for instance, has hymns that are in different languages and different traditions, as opposed to just as though it's coming straight out of the 18th century.
I would think that would be a draw, though, you know, rather than, you know, having people. I would think that would.
Oh, it is. It's a great draw.
Yeah.
It's a great draw.
Mm. Any thoughts on that?
I think for us, as for many, many churches and probably synagogues, too, it's changed in the way that almost all women go to work nowadays, and you don't have that volunteerism in your church anymore that you could rely upon, and I think that's changed a lot of the ways that we do things, and certainly, and I do agree. Well, perhaps you haven't hit upon this, but I think there's a certain evolution that goes on in your church as goes on in the rest of the society. Some of it is a devolution in that it's materialistic. Mm. And on the other hand, I think people are willing to lay aside to be a little bit more accepting of others and other religions. So that's on the positive side what's going on, right?
I think there's more cosmopolitanism. Years ago, people would do practices only from the religious tradition. But if I mention something about energy work or Buddhist meditation or perhaps Sufis, Muslims who are mystics, folks in my church know about it. They may already be practicing these things personally, and they haven't even shared them with their pastor. And, of course, one of the things I'm interested in is having people being open about their faiths and sharing their experience. So that cosmopolitanism is really, in my mind, key as a way of looking at people doing a variety of hybrid things. In the 1950s, which was kind of the heyday of Protestantism and Christianity and perhaps religious institutions in the States, people were publicly religious. They went to church. They never talked about spirituality in public. Mm. Nowadays, people are not going to church as often. Maybe only 25% to 30% go on a weekend to any religious institution. But people talk about spirituality and near-death experiences and mysticism in ways that they hadn't
that's
in
a really
previous
good
generations.
Point. We're going to get to that. But you brought up something that it used to be that we were born into a church and we stayed there. And
yes.
Now people, as you say, are moving in and out of different churches. And for many, the relationship with the church or religion changes throughout the course of our lives.
Well, isn't that the truth? I mean, I think each one of us, at least with probably has seen people come from a variety of traditions that are now at our church. At South Congregational in Centerville, we have folks who are Episcopalian and Methodist, Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, Disciples of Christ, Baptist, who come there for a variety of reasons. It's close to home. Their kids like it. They like the music. They might like the pastor. It's a village church. And all those things enter in, whereas at one point in time, you were born Baptist.
Right,
I mean, I was
Baptist.
Raised a Baptist. I'm now a United Church of Christ. And so I'm one of those folks, too.
Yeah.
In the Jewish world, we deal with some challenges that pose their own kinds of problems, because it's pretty much a given within the Jewish world that one can self-identify as a Jew without any religious affiliation whatsoever. There's a cultural self-identification. And so a recent Jewish population study reflects high numbers of people who will self-identify, call themselves Jews, but who may have no need of a synagogue or a structured community. And so that becomes a challenge, certainly within my world.
Absolutely. We're talking about the evolution of faith and religion. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, our number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. And press the number 5 to get into the program. Or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what is the difference between spirituality and religion? Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I think that most people, if you look at what they're assuming, they think that you can't be spiritual in church. But that's not at all the case. So we all have a certain prayer or meditation traditions, and we have the rituals that are evoking the spiritual. And so I think that most people nowadays say, oh, I'm spiritual, because they don't want to have the commitment of going to church and participating and becoming part of a community and taking on some responsibilities in that community too.
I tend to define religion as the vessel which has the potential for containing spiritual experience. And I think, sadly, many people find that the religious experiences that they may have grown up with are no longer suitable vessels to contain that.
And many people, I think of religions as ancient, unchanging, inflexible, intolerant. Spirituality is open-ended, flexible, experiential. Our goal, I think, is to be spiritual and religious, to have a community that we might call home, that gives us meaning, that shapes our lives, and at the same time we can experience the holiness of life. We can experience, as Rabbi Heschel would say, the radical amazement of just awakening on this glorious day on Cape Cod. And you can be both, and I think that's, for us in the Christian family, we have a lot of bad press because many people think that our churches are intolerant, inflexible, when in fact that isn't our church. Our church is welcoming to all people and has a strong spiritual bent to it, and that's probably true for all the congregations around here, whether they be Jewish or Christian, at least around this table.
I think it's also, though, I think, or maybe a point of intersection is when I when Mindy asked the question, I was thinking about creed and the role of creed, and one sense of creed is credo, and what do we give our heart to? And so that sense of the institution was what the religions were. I think that sense of something that was fixed, and spirituality had more of a sense of fluidity to it. But that nonetheless is that sense of what is it that we can open our hearts to?
Yeah. Well, in some faiths, people have struggled, as you're saying, with maintaining a relationship with a church whose doctrine they identify with, but whose actions they disagree with. And, you know, we've had a lot of that happening in the Catholic Church. So how do you overcome that? How do you overcome that mindset of people go, well, the church is, you know, like saying inflexible, and you know it's your church is not. So how do you get that message out or get people to try it?
I think you have to be boldly in your differentiation. Again, I think most of the studies that I've worked with indicate that younger people are more of none of the above. That's doubled and tripled in the last couple decades. That many people identify churches with the what I'd call the worst common denominator. You shout it from the pulpit. You do programs. I mean, we do meditation group. I'll be going to that later this afternoon, a couple ones on Wednesdays that involve global meditation, Christian in orientation. We do Lectio Divina, but we also do breath prayer. And the majority of people who attend those are not members of our church. They see the lawn signs on Main Street in Centerville, a Still Point meditation group. They come in. We say all questions are welcome at this church. All families are welcome. All questions are welcome. This is a place where all are pilgrims and none are strangers.
Mm. Anybody else have thoughts on how they get people to know what's going on in your church or synagogue?
Well, I think that one of the things that some churches struggled with was homosexuality, of having also, in fact, taking the next step, not mm-hmm. just accepting of homosexuality, but accepting of gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And that did happen in my church. It's over a decade ago now. But people did leave. It was before I came.
Right.
And people did leave when we took a stand and they left. Mm-hmm. And sometimes mm-hmm. that will happen, that you will lose some people because we have to take a stand for social justice sometimes, and that can cost us when we do that.
Mm-hmm.
But then others come in as a result of our opening up to that, and so you don't really lose. I think you even shore up your identity and it lets you know who you really are mm-hmm. when you stand up for social justice. Yeah.
It's also, I think, one of the things for me that's very moving is when we, when the doors are open, when they literally in the summer, the doors are open. So anyone can come in. And I often will say to people, and especially because we're in a scientific community, you know, all of the whole of ourselves are welcome to this community. Don't just leave, you know, your brains outside mm-hmm. the door.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or part of yourself outside the door, that all are welcome. The whole of ourself is welcome into the community. But also, Mindy, when you asked the question, I was thinking about how I remember in 1974 when women's ordination was, or 1973 when it was voted down in the Episcopal Church. And I remember thinking, do I stay within the Episcopal Church or do I go to a denomination that already accepted women in terms of the ordained ministry?
Mm.
And I stayed with the Episcopal Church. So there's a piece of me that stays within the institution, though I am not afraid of speaking up to the institution mm-hmm. and helping to reframe and reshape that institution. With that sense of openness and what is it that we're called upon to do as a religious and a faith yeah. community.
That's a struggle. That had to be a struggle for you, that question of do I stay in the Episcopal Church or, you know, or I go somewhere with it where women are welcome.
I think that is, but I think it's also a question that probably all of us have gone mm-hmm. through in terms of our faith tradition.
I would imagine that all of us sitting around this table have had the experience of having members of our communities who were, how shall I put it, nonplussed by stances that we may have taken mm-hmm. and perhaps threatened to leave the community, but who, because of a fundamental recognition and respect for our integrity, may have been persuaded to stay in the community or to understand mm-hmm. that while we may not speak their party line, mm-hmm. we have a voice worth listening to.
Exactly. We are talking about the evolution of faith and religion, and with us this morning, Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville, Deborah Warner, rector at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, Elias Lieberman, rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation, and Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven. We'll talk more after a quick break.
Earl Mills Sr., Chief Flying Eagle of the Mashpee Wampanoag.
And many times I'll be doing something and my parents or my grandmother will come into my consciousness. We believe as a people that if you can walk in those same footsteps down to Walk White Bay or South Cape Beach, that we could feel that energy of our ancestors. And so I would get up and I'd burn the tobacco at sunrise. It's like a meditational kind of feeling. And the energy that I find in that area where that ancestor used to wander or go clamming, we would exchange those energies. And I come away re-energized and ready to face the day.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
I'm Marco Werman. We've been covering security and privacy on The World. On our next edition, we're in Russia, where people assume the government's always listening.
Everyone believes that he's been under surveillance. The big brother is watching you.
And that's something most Russians are okay with. Russians and surveillance, next time on The World. Tonight at 8 on WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the evolution of faith and religion with Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville, Deborah Warner, rector at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, Elias Lieberman, rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation, and Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, and hit the number 5. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'd love to hear your thoughts on our conversation this morning. You touched on this a little bit. There's always been a link between politics and religion, but the lines between the two are getting blurred for many people. So what role do you see faith and religion playing in politics, and how are people balancing their religious beliefs with their political views?
One of the organizations that's affiliated with the Reform movement in Judaism, the branch of Judaism that I represent, is an institution called the Religious Action Center, based in Washington, D.C. And it is a lobbying group firmly based in Jewish values and traditions. And so for me, it represents really the very best of Judaism and that interface with politics, which really says, how shall we be engaged in the world? It doesn't please everyone,
right?
But
you can't. That's the
nature of the
game. You can't please everyone, right?
Right.
Anybody else have thoughts on that?
No. Well, following in the footsteps of the ancient prophets, I have around my pulpit in Fairhaven, the major prophets are carved in the pulpit. Mm-hmm. So when anyone in my congregation begins to complain that I'm getting too political, I say, around this pulpit are all of the major prophets, and what they stood for was to call us to justice. So I think that being in a religion like ours, we're practically having to be called to justice, because it's part of our reason for being is to be right with one another and right with society and to work for things in society that are just plain wrong. Like, you know, currently it's the pay equity, being paid sufficiently so you can live on your salary. We've got to find a way of this not happening. It's just not. It mars the worth and dignity of people. And so we have to work on these issues. And so, yes, let's walk in the footsteps of the major prophets and do it.
Well, I think that it's built in. South Congregation was a village church, and actually one of the pivotal moments for the church's life was in the 1850s when it declared itself an abolitionist church. And, we kind of follow the policy of acting locally and thinking globally. The prophetic tradition is always embodied. You can't avoid it. Mm-hmm. I think where we are, we start locally with the schools, with concern for Habitat for Humanity, with concern for homelessness, with care for people who are vulnerable, and then work our way outward to try to figure out how to be appropriately political as a consensus-type church. Mm-hmm. We're probably moderate in our politics, and so we need to do things in a consensus way while yet having a sort of prophetic edge toward the least of these.
Mm-hmm. I think that's certainly true, and that's certainly true in our parish at the Church of the Messiah, that has had a long history in terms of stance, in terms of what could be called political issues. It was very involved in terms of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. in the 60s, in terms of the pastoral leadership at that point. Through the years has done other things. We're currently quite engaged in terms of gun violence issues, in terms of legislation. I certainly am committed to that. And also in terms of environmental concerns, which some people could call political. I prefer to think of them in terms of ecological as well as economical.
Mm-hmm. Oh, since you mentioned the gun violence, you have a vigil coming up.
We have a vigil coming up in Falmouth on December 14th at 6 o'clock at the Peg Noonan Park, and it's simply a time for people to gather in a quiet place, a candlelight vigil. It will not be a time for speeches. It will just be a chance for people to gather and think about the 26 people who were killed at the Sandy Hook School, the shooter, his mother, and then the 30,000 people who have been killed in this country since that date. So that's a chance for us within the local community to remember that event in the midst of the busyness of the season.
As religious leaders, how do you decide what political or social issues to involve the congregation with, and how do you mediate when parishioners have different views on these issues?
It's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The structure of our congregation is such that we have a committee called a Social Action Committee, whose mandate is to bring to the attention of the congregation social justice issues. I have a talented staff colleague, Pamela Rothstein, our director of programming and learning. And so the two of us work closely with that committee and identify issues that we think are worthy of the congregation's attention. We may turn to our monthly newsletter, our Facebook page. We invite speakers in, films, discussions. Mm-hmm. We always run the risk that we're going to make people unhappy, but it falls out on both sides.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose like when you have a film or a lecture, you have this opportunity for a conversation anyway. And sometimes, you know, when you get those conversations going, somebody who thinks they think one way is maybe persuaded that they, you know, they didn't have all the information or what have you. Yeah.
Well, I think one of our goals is to be in conversation and to go beyond the sort of knee-jerk approaches of both some liberals and some conservatives and try to find that common ground. As a congregational-type church, we don't have a strict party line.
Mm-hmm.
We have diverse opinions, and one of my goals is to seek the common ground. We're focused on children and housing in our community and move from that small local to say, well, how do we take care of other people's children? Mm-hmm. How do we ensure that everyone has housing in our neighborhood? And that eventually that becomes political. And I think my concern as a pastor is that we do it, not necessarily with concern maybe how we do it is not as important as that we do it. Mm-hmm. Whether we do it politically in the governmental sphere or the private sphere, it probably needs both, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
But how we do it as a community and yet keep in conversation, because, of course, our media wants us to be separated over the smallest issues become bones of contention. And I think that's always been a problem in religious communities, is to make a small issue of disagreement a reason to split rather than finding a common ground.
Mm. I think that in every congregation you will have people who have a passion for certain things and not mm-hmm. others. There may not be a disagreement necessarily. It'll be more a passion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way to have the Social Justice Committee is certainly the way that they can take their passion to the Social Justice Committee, express the concern, say, what can we do about it? And the Social Justice Committee's job is to help them garner other support for that so that they can have that feeling of satisfaction. So, no, you won't get everyone on the same page about anything, but you can usually get them on the same page about the big issues,
mm-hmm.
Like the equality, you know, pay equality and social economic justice. You can usually get them on the same page about that.
Yeah. I think the other thing, the role, though, is so interesting, is that people feel a sense of being welcomed nonetheless, mm-hmm. Where they may be of different places. And I think that's part of our role in terms of being a pastoral presence, that we are people know certainly what some of my passions are, but nonetheless, there's a sense of respecting the dignity of everyone that's there. In fact, that's one of the tenets in terms of our tradition, in terms of the Episcopal Church. We put it in terms of the baptismal covenant. We respect the dignity of every human being. Mm. And we take that, I mean, we try to take that to heart and live with that, both locally within the parish, but also within the community, and then in terms of our actions with others and around the world.
I think I'd like to add to that I think that doing social justice in a church or synagogue or a temple, I think that it has a special aspect to it, because we try to have some spiritual underpinnings mm-hmm. to this social justice. That's very different than, so you don't want to come from towards it from a place of anger,
right.
but from a place of justice, something that's deep within you.
I think the prayerful approach, and of course as a community that seeks to affirm diversity, we have to also seek to affirm political diversity
mm-hmm.
and diversity of theologies, lifestyles, families. And oftentimes we have our comfort zones of diversity, but if you really want to be open to pluralism and
yes.
diversity, you have to take it as it is. You know, have to take yeah. as it is.
And some of us may even say from the pulpit, and you can be a Republican here.
We are talking about the evolution of faith and religion. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. And then press the number 5. You can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So it used to be that religion was seen as a structure within which we live our lives as preparation for the afterlife. But nowadays, the role of religion church seems to be more focused on the now. Why do you think that's changed?
Well, I think it used to be the case that many people in the Christian tradition were referred to as so heavenly minded that they were no earthly good. And I think these days, I think that there's a public interest in the afterlife. It's interesting, going back to an early comment in the 50s, people went to church, but they didn't talk about spirituality.
Right.
And outside the church, they typically didn't talk about the afterlife, mystical experiences, encounters with God. Of course, people now self-report twice as many mystical experiences, 50% report that now, as in contrast to 40 years ago when it was 25%. I think the public has been shaped by books and the media has been shaped by the public interest. Of course, we have bestsellers on survival after death. Yeah, we have the Oprah sort of movement that people will talk about spirituality on television. And some of us think you can be both heavenly minded and earthly good. We can believe in the afterlife and yet be concerned with justice here and care for this life as being important too. We don't have to go to a better place. We're already in a very good place if this world is holy.
One of the things that I cherish the most about Judaism is that while it certainly posits theories about what might happen to the fate of our soul after we die, the emphasis has long been on the opportunities we have while we're alive. And when I have conversations with folks who are nearing the end of their lives or may have anxiety about what might happen after their death, I certainly encourage them to share their concerns, their theories, but I'm very quick to say no one has the answer.
Mm-hmm.
We know we're blessed with the time that we have, and certainly I come from a faith tradition which says make the most of that. Mm-hmm. Do what you can while you're here.
I, as Elias has just said, I also think part of our role is both in terms of pastoral presence, but also as a community, is in terms of people's, as their life does draw to a close, that sense in terms of that their death is one that's a good death, that there's a sense of, you know, if there's a way of our alleviating suffering or pain or fear, of being able to do that, and that sense of just being a companion at that point in our lives.
Yeah, it's amazing how much a pastor or a rabbi deals with death.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my seminary students commented to me during their internships, I didn't know death was so much part of ministry.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a newcomer, just here a few months on the Cape since July, and I've done 5 funerals already. I hope to have a break for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
But we're always dealing with death and grief and loss. And at least as in the Christian tradition, we don't necessarily describe the heavenly journey in too much specifics, but we can say that God is present in life and death, or nothing can separate us from the love of God, and do that with conviction, knowing that we don't have to know all the details, but we can provide a promise of hope.
Yeah.
In my tradition, we went through a very long period of humanism, and so whether there was life after death, it was just not an issue. But that was really a tyranny of the majority,
mm-hmm.
Because people did want to talk about, they did want to talk about what do we think about it. I find myself that if it's an older person, that there's a reluctance to talk about it at all. And I may end up saying, do you want to know what I think? And sometimes they'll say, yes, I do. So I do think that there is a fear when they do come to death, even though I don't think they believe in hell as we have known it, or actually in heaven. I think they want to be assured that there is perhaps a chance that consciousness goes on.
Well, it's that fear of the unknown, isn't it?
Yes.
You don't know what's going to happen. And as you said, Elias, nobody really knows, do we? So, yeah. Since we're talking about death, religion and faith often play a large role when we're talking dealing with death. And this goes back to what we're discussing, you know, about afterlife and the uncertainty. But do you help members of your congregation deal with the death of a loved one? You were talking about the person themselves, excuse me, who's dying or near death. But what about the you know, person who's lost someone? How do you deal with that?
I think for me, probably the most, out of 30 years of ministry, ordained ministry, the most moving experience I had was last year when a young man in the community died. And he had grown up at the Church of the Messiah. He died very suddenly in a car accident. And there was a sense of great grief that the parish felt, but there was this great sense of grief in the community. And so when it came time for his funeral, and actually that whole week, it was the community that was mourning and celebrating his life with the family. Mm. And the service ended up being grounded within the Episcopal tradition, and yet had elements of his life. So, for instance, his brother's band played at the end of the service, so that there was a sense of honestly trying to say, this is who this person was and is to us. And I think if we can do that, is a wonderful, wonderful kind of tribute, both to the individual, but also being part of a faith community.
And to honor people's grief in its many forms. People not only grieve their loved human ones, but I've done pastoral care with people who are grieving their companion animals, the death of a dog that was beloved. And I think one of the things that our institutions do at their best is to welcome the whole variety of grief experience, spiritual experience, and be a place where nothing's off the table and people can be their full selves with all their questions and their doubts, and don't have to be some sort of perfect Christian to show up there, but to be a place where everything's welcome and on the table. And of course, I think spiritual leaders are called to create that atmosphere.
And then sometimes there's complicated grief. We are always learning from our congregants. And I remember particularly a member of my community who came to me and said, you know, I know the tradition calls upon me to recite the mourner's prayer each year on the anniversary of my mother's death. My mother was abusive. I had no loving relationship with her. What do I do? I feel drawn by the tradition. And so I took a page from Rabbi Harold Kushner, that wonderful conservative rabbi from Natick, best known for authoring When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he counseled a congregant who also had an abusive parent. And he said, look, your father died. You feel drawn by the tradition to the rites of mourning. But I suggest that you mourn the father you should have had and deserved and did not have.
Oh, wow.
And channel your grief that way. And I thought that was great advice.
Yeah, that is great advice.
I also, like Deborah, I like the idea of being with, and I think that the person has lost, you know, connection is what we're all about in a church, having that connection. And they have lost their connection with their beloved. And so I think that we have to do our best to be, to connect them with others, because the chances are that they're feeling depressed and alone and withdrawn, and you want to keep that connection. Yeah. And we do our best to do it with people in our congregation. So if you can connect one widow to another, that's a good idea.
Idea. We are talking about the evolution of faith and religion, and our toll-free number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a short break.
There's a first time for everything. First dates, first jobs, your first driveway moment with public radio.
Support WCAI with a gift in any amount for the first time, or just the first time in a while, and you'll be counted in our 4 for Feb challenge. 400 gifts between now and the end of the year, and February will go fundraiser-free on WCAI. Be a part of it. Call 855-469-9224.
There's a lot of women that have this other kind of wild side. So we come up with different things that most social meetup groups do. We try to do things with a little edge to it. And we call ourselves the Sassy Seniors.
Jerry Moore of West Barnstable.
One of the first activities was that there was a woman who was 53 who had been married for 20-plus years and actually married her high school sweetheart. Reluctantly, she did admit that she often wondered what it would be like to sit at a bar by yourself. So we just all teamed together. We went shopping with her. We actually went to Forever 21 to get her a slinky red dress. She sat at the bar, ordered a Cosmopolitan. We had coached her on, you know, befriend your bartender. We were just back there laughing, and we'd just give her the okay signal.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
It just gave her a little boost, and she still has the red dress.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the evolution of faith and religion with Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville, Deborah Warner, rector at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole, Elias Lieberman, rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation, and Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation, or if you have a comment or question for us. 866-999-4626. Hit the number 5. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. John is giving us a call from Dennis. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
Okay.
It's extraordinarily profound what we're doing here. My father was a pathologist and a theologian, and I just demolished 50,000 volume library. Excuse me. It's getting overwhelming here. But the simple fact of the matter is that I am an atheist. He was a he was incredibly involved in theology, and he taught me to become an atheist. And the issue is simply that we must understand that we do not do God stuff in reality.
Right. Dennis,
God is made in your mind.
All right. Dennis, well, we appreciate you sharing your views with us, and I'm sure there are others in the audience who would probably agree with you. That's, I guess, part of what we were talking about earlier, welcoming to all thoughts and having diversity. So we appreciate that, John. Thanks for calling in. 866-999-4626. Hit the number 5. Anybody else have any comments?
Yeah. Well, let me just say, I think that with that, though, with John's comment, which is one of the things that's scary is when the image of God and our sense of God is really a projection of something that we want or need, and so it becomes can become a wrathful image, and people just live into that and act on it, and I mean the atrocities that have occurred in terms of history because of that, so.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate John's comments. I suspect that there are Johns in all of our communities and mm-hmm. congregations. And certainly one of the most powerful experiences I've had as a rabbi is when I chose a few years ago over a course of High Holy Day sermons to talk about my own understanding of God and where I draw the line and my many, many doubts. And the response was just enormous because obviously I was speaking to people who were finally given permission, they felt, mm-hmm. to talk about their doubts, to admit that they're atheists but proud Jews mm-hmm. or whatever the self-description might be. Mm-hmm. So we need Johns in our communities mm-hmm. and we need them to be outspoken.
Well, and questions. Don't we all have questions?
Well, yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know Madeleine L'Engle, the author, was once asked if she, do you believe in God without any doubt? Her response was, I believe in God with all my doubts. Mm-hmm. And atheists provide a certain type of theological Lysol. they in some sense, cleanse certain types of religiosity. And, of course, some of the most religiously interested people I know are atheists because they are people with questions. Mm-hmm. They have images of God that they don't believe in that often invite us to ponder what images of God we might believe in mm-hmm. and are functional and healthy rather than dysfunctional and destructive. And usually I don't believe in their God either. I don't believe in the God they disbelieve in either. And so it's often a fruitful conversation, and it helps people of faith not to be overly glib. Mm-hmm. You know, too many televangelists talk about hurricanes coming to punish New Orleans or Haiti and earthquakes in Haiti. And to me, that's somewhat blasphemous, that God really is not in the business of destruction mm-hmm. or choosing who's in and who's out and penalizing people for finite sins with eternal punishment. But as a believer, you know, as one of you commented about bringing your whole self to church, the whole self is the doubting self as well as the believing self and the trusting self as well as the, oh my gosh, I have no clue what's going on self.
And I've just done a sermon last Sunday on God. And I believe that a lot of these people who come into church and say, you know, I'm not really religious, I'm spiritual, I think that it's the God issue that they're spiritual around. Personally, mm-hmm. I rather love the books of John Shelby Spong, mm-hmm. an Episcopal bishop. Mm-hmm. And I like how he talks about God in such a free way that for him, God is not the jealous God, the God who favors, that God is in the spirit. Mm. And in fact, there was a point at which Jesus was called a spirit person, that sort of makes a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. And so I suspect a lot of people who say that they're atheists, what they have a trouble with is a God that they just cannot subscribe to.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the role of ritual in religion. Why do you think ritual is so important to us?
I'll share a family story, which I often share because it really speaks to that point. Mm. My mother, of blessed memory, did not have a Hebrew education because girls were not afforded that opportunity when she was growing up. And so the prayers that she learned by memory. Mm. And so our Sabbath evening ritual of lighting candles to welcome the Sabbath fell to her as a traditional woman's role. And the accompanying prayers. And as I came of age and I did learn Hebrew and I learned those prayers, I became aware of the mistakes that she was making. Mm-hmm. And of course, with my great love for my mom, I would never point that out. But had I suggested to her that perhaps it would be better for her to simply do the blessing in translation in English, she would have been greatly offended. Mm-hmm. There was power in that ritual which spoke to her of family, of her experience of Shabbat, the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And it's especially true when mourners rise at the end of our service to recite the mourner's Kaddish, that mm-hmm. prayer. To suggest that they do it in any other language would be blasphemy. Mm-hmm. It functions in many ways like a mantra, yeah. and I think that's a great example of the power of ritual. Yeah.
Anybody else have thoughts on that?
Well, I think that human beings are ritualistic anyway, whether we are religious or not. There's that thing about lighting a candle, just the simple act of lighting a candle. They love to have a candle. Why do they love to have a candle? Mm-hmm. It's ritual, so yes. In fact, we Unitarian Universalists didn't have a symbol for a long time. And there was a sort of vacuum there, and somebody suggested, why don't we use this symbol that the Unitarian Service Committee has? It's an open chalice. It's a chalice with a very wide chalice with a candle in the middle. And we light it for so many different occasions with a particular focus. And mm-hmm. I think we were just recognizing that we can't toss out all of the ritual because it's in us.
Yeah,
I think ritual joins order and novelty. I think we can't neglect tradition because it's deep in the bones, especially when we're trying to do innovative things. Mm-hmm. People who no longer have any conscious experience oftentimes can still say the Lord's Prayer. They can still sing the hymns. So quite often I'll go into a nursing home and sing hymns, and I was fortunately born a Baptist. So I know all the old Protestant hymns, have it by heart pretty much. And if scripture memorization is something that we don't do very often anymore. But if we see scripture as in a form of affirmations, short statements, then that moves from the conscious mind to the unconscious. So it's okay for people off to come only on Christmas, although we might like them to come other times than Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. It serves something that ties the year together, the mm-hmm. earth seasons and the Christian calendar, the Hanukkah and the Thanksgiving season and the solstice. All of these are part of the sort of passing of the year that's mm-hmm. always changing, but there also is that novelty in the course of the – an order in the course of the novelty.
One of the most moving times I had in terms of a Holy Week experience was – or that grows out of the Holy Week experience is in the Episcopal liturgy on this – on Saturday – on Holy Thursday, Maundy Thursday. There, at the end of the service, there's something called the stripping of the altar where everything is removed from the altar. And that sense of preparing the space in terms of Jesus's trial and crucifixion the following day. And I remember being with a woman who was 40 years old who was dying of cancer in a hospice. And I remember coming in and helping to prepare the room with her family. And so every time I do that service, I think of that. Mm-hmm. I think of Denise, and I think mm-hmm. of that sort of that preparing that space, and so it's a way of making that connection. Both, what it's like for the congregation, but also in terms of my own journey as a pastor and as a person of faith.
Traditionally, different faith congregations have remained isolated from one another, but it seems that we're now seeing more and more collaborations across different faith groups. Why do you think that? Is it part of the times in which we live?
Well, I think I'm going to raise here, we've become a green sanctuary. I think the ecological justice, I think certainly the Episcopal Church was first in, bringing to mind the Interfaith, Power and Light mm-hmm. organization. I think that really lit up for many organizations, and they've pulled together that to inspire us all to be in some way or another a green community. And I think that this is, something that we have done together. We've tried to get our church into church councils, for example, to mm-hmm. get on board as well. Doesn't always work, but you can try.
But I agree with you, Anne. I think that's something that it's the moral issue of our day and yes. the moral imperative for all communities of faith, regardless of the creeds with which they're endowed, to come to the conversation, to share in the conversation with scientists, with economists, that we, given what we have, what is at stake, we have to come together. So I think that's the current issue. And I think as far as I understand it, it is the only issue. And until we work on that together, mm-hmm. It's going to be other conversations can happen. But that's the one that's a moral imperative.
Mm-hmm. I think that sense of connection between faith communities has waxed and waned and waxed over the decades. And I think it's most successful when we identify particular causes or needs. Falmouth just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Falmouth Service Center. And at its celebration, it was pointed out correctly that it was started by a group of clergy here in town. And I think that's a beautiful, powerful example of when faith communities come together effectively and for all the right reasons.
Yeah,
I'd say that we have done this in Centerville around housing and education. We're fairly very active in Habitat for Humanity, and we do that with other congregations. And I think that you look for the common cause. I think also in this particular time, the pluralism of the time engages people across traditions. People go to different congregations where they might not have otherwise. They know the spiritual practices of other religious traditions. They intermarry. Interfaith marriages are pretty commonplace. They're not. When I was a boy, when a Protestant married a Catholic, that was a big deal. Now, when in my job as a university chaplain at Georgetown, I probably did a couple hundred interfaith weddings with the university rabbi, and that was a sort of a necessity in the community. There's controversy about that, but it had something to do with the experiential rather than the doctrinal and the sociological realities at the time.
It's funny you said. I was thinking as you were talking about that, when I was growing up, I grew up in the Episcopal Church, and the Catholic Church was a few doors down. My cousin was in the Catholic Church, and I was in the Episcopal Church, and my grandmother was like, don't you dare set foot in that Catholic church. And I always thought, what would happen if I go in there? And I, so of course, being a curious kid, I did have to go in there. And of course it was.
You survived.
I survived, yes. We have less than a minute left. Any closing thoughts?
Well, I think the closing thought for me might be to continue the journey, that faith is a journey, that it's a pilgrimage with the answers are on the horizon. But we live it out moment by moment and day to day in healing the earth in Tikkun.
I'd wish everyone the blessings of the season.
Anybody else?
I would invite listeners who are not part of a church to go and try out your local church.
All right. And also continue the conversation with your neighbors. There you go. All right. Ann Fox, minister at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fairhaven. Elias Lieberman, rabbi at the Falmouth Jewish Congregation. Deborah Warner, rector at the Church of Messiah in Woods Hole. And Bruce Epperly, pastor at the South Congregational Church in Centerville. Thank you all for being here this morning.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.